Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mliwa Gavaza, and for today, usually on a Friday, we get into the hard economics of the week, and it's no different this week, but we are sort of taking a slightly different point of view, looking at a branch of the economy that has a lot of sway into what actually happens, you know, in the world of investments and markets and all of that. And that is political leadership, that is governance in the country. And there's a lot going on at the moment, especially when you just look at what's going on this week. Former President Jacob Zuma's refusal to attend the Zondo Committee, together with what's been happening with some of the top political figures such as Ace Magashule of the ANC. And we're just here to talk about what the possible economic implications might be, but more importantly, where does governance lend itself when it comes to the direction that a country takes. And to help us to unpack these issues, we are joined by Professor Lawrence Hamilton, who is a specialist. He is a professor of political studies at Wits University, and he's also the SAUK Saatchi Bilateral Research Chair in Political Theory, and that's between Wits University and Cambridge. So, Prof, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mudiwa. Many thanks for the invitation. And as you said, good morning, good day, good evening to all the listeners.
I think a good place for us to start is getting into, I guess, one of the things that people tend to be very wary about in South Africa. We can dress it up in many nice terms, but I guess corruption is usually a nice way to sort of frame a lot of the underhanded dealings and some of the, you know, bitter tastes that are left in people's mouths when you hear about what's actually going on with some of the state funds. So when it comes to corruption, how does that, I guess, lend itself to either hurting the common man on the street or just hurting our economy as a whole?
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, at a very simple and obvious level, at a starting point, you're absolutely right. Of course, the rhetoric and the discourse around corruption is particularly vocal in a place like South Africa. I mean, I work, as you've just said, between two countries, the UK and South Africa. And ever since the Zuma era, but also before it, there's you know, it's very, very marked when you spend time in South Africa how significant the corruption discourse is. But the other thing to point out is that the reason that we are seeing so much of it right now is not necessarily because there is an increase in corruption in the last while. What we may be seeing is the consequence of a change of regime, a change of faction in power in the ANC, and the fact that that faction is slowly getting the state agencies to carry out the jobs they're supposed to carry out as regards corruption. And so we're starting to slowly see the effects of that. And these things do take time. I mean, obviously, everyday citizens expect people to be thrown in jail, you know, overnight. But they do take a hell of a lot of time. Maybe, I mean, I'm not trying to let the ANC off the hook in any sense. But from my perspective, as someone who sees this in the long durée and sees it in comparative perspective compared to places like America and the UK and Brazil and India, actually these events that you've just spoken about, Zuma before the Zondo Commission, Zuma potentially being arrested, Ace Magashule in court today, these are major political events, and they are as a consequence of a hell of a lot of activity behind the scenes, mainly the state agencies actually carrying out their basic functions, but also political activity to ensure that these state agencies do carry out these functions. Just to come to your question, Obviously, if, and this doesn't just apply to state officials, it applies to private businesses and private corporations, people like the Guptas, and as I'm sure we'll find out, very many more. If they're involved in funneling public monies, monies that come from taxpayers and that are supposed to be providing goods and services to citizens of South Africa, if those monies are being funneled away into private bank accounts here and abroad, then they're going to have very serious effects on the capacity for the state to deliver, the state to provide the services it's not only supposed to provide in some sense, but has also promised that it would provide, right? It has a very significant effect in that, in the basic capability of the state in sheer financial terms. The state is a huge player in our economy. It is the most significant agent in the South African economy. And if it cannot, if it is losing, if money is leaking from holes everywhere, then how can that single most important agent be acting in a responsible and in an effective way?
And, you know, one of the things that I like that you said you look at some of these things, you know, comparatively, and you do work between two countries. So with that sort of, insight, how would you say, are there measures of to say that this country is more corrupt than another? Because, you know, I think South Africans might want to know within the broader context, you know, are we that bad? You know, when one sort of compares governance in South Africa, you know, to other parts of the world.
So, yes, I mean, there is little doubt that the corruption index places us middle to low middle in that regard. So there are very many countries that are way better than us, but there are also very many that are way worse than us. So like other middle-income countries, Turkey, etc., we battle with these kind of problems. But I think that what's more interesting than the exact position we may sit in as regards that corruption index, what's more important is what's happened to us since the beginning of the Zuma era. So there is little doubt that Mbeki was running at a tighter ship in this regard, and that as soon as Zuma came into power, we, in hindsight, can now say that, all of the things that we know about this term state capture, the processes of various agencies of the state being bought off for sectional interests, i.e. Zuma and his acolytes' interests, rather than serving the public good in some sense, whatever that public good may be, yes, most definitely, we have seen a very, very sharp increase in corruption since the beginning of that era, and we're now in the process of cleaning it up. So, but to give you another side of that story, you know, places, then it may not be very helpful places to compare ourselves to, but places like Brazil are easily as corrupt as South Africa, if not worse so. And another thing to compare ourselves to is our own history, right? So we in contemporary South Africa, in post-apartheid South Africa, have become very obsessed with corruption, and rightly so, as I say, particularly since the start of the Zuma era. But the apartheid state was an extremely corrupt state, and particularly in its later years, it was outlandishly corrupt. This notion, this common notion that post 1994 South Africa disappeared down a hole of corruption is just a completely incorrect representation of the facts on the ground.
Actually, Prof, as you're talking, I'm listening to what you're saying, and especially what you've just said, where talking about corruption in the apartheid era, and then you have independence in 1994, and then we're now so focused on what's going on. Would it be a stretch to say that Perhaps part of the issue is the fact that as much as there's been work, as there's been a lot of work to write some of the, you know, branches of the state, the judiciary, the government, you know, all of those different branches of the government, that in essence, it's still inherently the same system, right? That the system of governance, and, you know, I would also venture to say that in a lot of African countries, right, the system of governance has been inherited, you know, from what was happening before independence. So you sort of swap out the players, but the game is still the same. And the game before independence was inherently corrupt because it was systematically designed to benefit a few. So, you know, would it be a stretch to say, why are we even surprised that there's corruption?
Yes, I mean, I think we need to distinguish two things here. And this is quite, it's a really helpful question because it allows me to bring in a distinction that is not found in public discourse at all. And that is a distinction between, say, corruption of particular officials, even corruption of amongst, you know, networks of officials, and networks of officials connected to networks of business people, etc. That kind of corruption versus what you might call systemic corruption. Okay? So that's the first thing to keep in mind, that there is a distinction and that we do come from a history of systemic corruption. I mean, to take just a few examples, a lot of our SOEs, our parastatals, whatever you want to call them, are in fact creations of the apartheid state. And their proximity to government and the seeming unwillingness of the ANC government to clean them up, to sell parts of them or all of them, actually harks back to an apartheid era attitude and policy to these state-owned enterprises. Even places like India, for example, you don't even have to go to the States or the UK or whatever, but even places like India have a long time ago sold off, if not all, large parts of their state-owned enterprises. So there's no reason for our states to be involved to such an extent in things like Telkom, SAA, it's even got stake in Vodacom. I mean, ought to be mostly privately run entities that generate, as a consequence, degrees of efficiency that unfortunately government cannot provide. Government can provide degrees of efficiency and provision that the market can't provide, for example, around transport. So one of the things that the ANC could and should have done, for example, is to take on the public good of how we overcome the legacies of apartheid, especially urban geographies and ways of moving people around. The taxi industry, PRASA, all of those things that come together to move people around big cities to get to work and back. That is an instance of where the state, PRASA is frankly another disaster, and it may get worse, but that is an area that the state could have stepped further into to regulate and control and to make more efficient. So some of the decisions have been, you know, so I'm not talking about simply a lack of decision making and judgment and movement over certain issues to get out, as it were. I'm also saying that there may be certain issues that the state ought to have got further involved in. So I'm not giving you a free market argument here. I'm giving you an argument about what sorts of public goods the market cannot respond to properly. And in those sorts of public goods, the state needs to step in and either own to a certain extent or at least regulate. And just to come to your final point, our attention is drawn by the media and by everyday events. When we see Inkandla and the Mkhonto we Sizwe Veterans Association outside Inkandla, defending Zuma. And when we see Ace Magashule today going into court for, you know, a multi-million rand case around asbestos, these obviously grab the headlines. But for me, as a political theorist and a political scientist, really what enables these kinds of actions is a macro political structure that we only in part inherited from apartheid, okay? So what we did is that we had a very important and very fraught and potentially really dangerous transition that was, of course, more than dangerous for a lot of people. Many people lost their lives. But in that transition, there were a couple of decisions made, especially around proportional representation and around our voting procedures, that have led to a macro political arena in which we do not, as everyday citizens, we do not select our own representatives from our own geographical constituencies and vote them in or vote them out of parliament. What we do is we vote parties into or out of parliament. Now, what does that do? That means that the party list, where you are on the party list and how much percentage your party wins in the election process, will determine whether you enter parliament or not. And so your master in that process is the party. It is not the people.
Yeah.
And under properly functioning democracy, your master as a representative, you're the agent of the people. What we have seen since we have changed this system from a Westminster model, from a constituency-based model, of course, there are a whole lot of varieties we could have used. We could have used versions of both, like they do in Germany. What we did is we went for a very simple version, which is a PR version where we vote in parties, not individuals. And then Parliament votes in the president. And, of course, all of that gives the ANC, as things stand at least, a great deal of power. And so, in a way, you can see the internal logic of corruption being one consequence of this, right? You can see that if everything comes down to the party, then, of course, there's lots of wriggle room for people to get involved with the party, make lots of money out of the party, and for those a little bit less virtuous than others, find people to corrupt very quickly. And, of course, the tender process is a perfect example. But my feeling is that we generated a constitution at the high tide of what's called human rights liberal democracy that generated a set of macro political arrangements that are not very good at giving citizens the power to hold their representatives accountable. Now, of course, citizens aren't the state agents to take people to court and to prosecute them. But what matters in politics, besides, of course, if you get involved in malfeasance and fraud, you may, hopefully, in a functioning democracy, be taken to court. What matters in politics is the competition for power, right? What matters, especially in democratic politics, is selling a vision to the people and asking them, do you want us as your leaders? We don't get that yet. We get asked to choose which party do you want to lead you. There's not much emphasis on the individuals. There's not much emphasis on the vision. There's not much emphasis on throughput. There's not much emphasis on accountability in general. And we can't say that person X, who represents me and my fellow members of this constituency, can, at the end of a 4 or 5 or 6 year period, vote that particular individual out of position of power. Of course, parties are always going to be part of modern politics. But what has happened in the South African case is that the party, and of course we're talking about the ANC because the ANC is the main party, but this would be the case if the DA were the main party. This would be the case if the EFF were the main party.
You know, to sort of draw on what you're saying, there's a piece, you know, that I wanted us to touch on before we come to the end of the discussion. And I think it lends itself to, you know, where you seem to be going right now about, you know, who is actually in power. Because when it comes to policy making then, all right, what is the incentive for decisions to be made in the public good, right? If there's an entrenched, I don't like using the words entrenched interest, but literally if there's an entrenched interest for you to sort of keep the status quo going, because the system can only change if Parliament decides, okay, we're going to change. But why should the system change if, as a majority or the person in power, you know that if the system changes, it takes away whatever, you know, bargaining power, whatever you have, you know. So, and also at the same time, there are also other issues of, if you think about what happens in the States when it comes to policy making, you know, they call it lobbying, but if it's the same thing is seen happening in Africa, it's called corruption and brown envelopes, politics and all of this stuff, right? So from I guess policy making point of view, as we round up, Prof, like how do we, I guess, change? Because as far as I can see, the most credible piece is the people, right? Like who would actually have the incentive to change the things would be the people, as opposed to, you know, those that are either in power or have the potential to be in power.
Yes, unfortunately, we're in a bit of a vicious circle. Two things. The first is we had a Van Zyl Slabbert Commission many years ago. And that was a commission drawn up to assess our macro political arrangements, or the way we elect officials to power, and thus the way we hold people accountable as regards policy formation and policy throughput, as you're talking about. So it's not inconceivable that those in those positions of power who want to keep the status quo might not have incentives brought onto them by the people to think about reorganizing their macro political structure. The other thing is, of course, that South Africa is a place of great and continual upheaval. So at the local level, lots of people go on what are called, rather strangely, service delivery protests. And the people that are the main targets for service delivery protests are often ward councillors. Seems to me being a ward councillor in this country is having the worst job on earth, because you're the one that gets the wrath of the people weighed upon you, when in fact you're mostly powerless. Your house gets burnt down, etc. So really, if the people want change, they have to threaten some kind of revolutionary action. They don't have to necessarily carry it out, but they have to come together in various formations and ask for a different arrangement. But just to be clear, no democratic arrangement can change the fact that there will be the possibility for various forms of corruption. Mm-hmm. So I'm not suggesting that by bringing this back to kind of macro political questions, that there is some perfect nirvana of a macro political organization or constitutional setup that would resolve these issues. Corruption is endemic everywhere, frankly, as you just pointed out in regards to the United States. But we can lessen it and we can control it. And you're right, the individuals that have the greatest interest in controlling it and changing it are the people. Unfortunately, in South Africa, of course, we have we have such high levels of inequality, we have such high levels of poverty, that many of our people are simply not, they don't have the time, the energy, the political will, or the political understanding to take these matters forward. And so, ironically enough, it comes back to certain kinds of virtuous elites, maybe within the ANC or outside the ANC, to take on those sectional interests. And for me, what's going on right now in the ANC is an attempt to do that. Now, it might fail, and there's going to be a lot of noise about it. You're going to hear the noise today outside the Bloemfontein High Court. But that is mostly just noise. The proof is going to be in the pudding. The proof is going to be in whether these big corrupt networks are brought to book and whether the state can recoup some of these funds. And that's a long time down the road, in my view. And it's that that South Africans should be watching, whether the Ramaphosa administration can succeed in that regard. And although people talk about how weak he is, my sense is that if he does show any degree of success, like real people in jail, real recouping of funds, you know, beyond dealing with the pandemic that we're dealing with now, then that will have very great consequences for our political makeup and for the control of corruption going forward. And if it means the ANC splits, which has also been suggested, all well and good for political competition.
So that's been us. We're talking to Professor Lawrence Hamilton, who is a political studies professor at Wits University and also SAUK Swachi Bilateral Research Chair in Political Theory between Wits and Cambridge, giving us some insight into how corruption lends itself to some of the, you know, tough economic decisions that we see. But more importantly, just talking about what governance looks like in South Africa, the system of governance and some of the holes in it, where corruption has been able to, you know, perhaps use the word thrive. And then he's just talking about the fact that, you know, one of the big issues is the fact that people are the ones that have the greatest interest in making things better, but they have structurally, they have the least amount of power or recourse when it comes to choosing who their direct leaders are and voting them in and out of power, which would be quite you know, good balancing mechanism when it comes to staving off some of the political interests and the way that they govern in South Africa. So that's been it. Prof, thank you so much for being with us.
That was wonderfully summed up, Mudiwe. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for the invitation. It's been great.
A very fascinating discussion with Prof. Hamilton around the state of governance in South Africa. Very important when you think about the economic policies that need to be put in place to actually right-size the country, because where, you know, how political interests are shaped sort of then shapes where the economy goes, because there is that tension between political interest versus the greater national good, an issue that the Prof. spent a long time talking about. But for me, it's the structural part that's quite fascinating, simply because I really think and feel that in Africa, you know, whether we're talking South Africa or other African countries that have similar pasts of, you know, colonial times, and then we're seeing massive amounts of corruption, is that there are conversations that need to be had about what it means to govern in an African way. And the reason I say that is because for a lot of people, it's simply been a swapping out of the players, it seems. That, you know, you swap out the players, people are on the field, they're playing hockey, you swap out the players, you know, it looks like a different game, but they are still playing hockey, essentially, right? Yeah, we might take away the hockey sticks and say that people should kick the ball and swap it out for a bigger rubber ball. And, you know, the game now becomes soccer, but in essence, people are still, you know, by and large doing about the same thing. So I think complete workaround really needs to be, you know, thought of. But once again, that stumbles because of entrenched interests. And what is the incentive, right? What is the incentive of changing the system when so many interests are benefiting from the status quo? As much as we may talk about having this egalitarian state and all the good that can come out of the world, the truth of the matter is people are eating, people are benefiting, people are prospering. So the incentive structure, to me, from an economist's point of view, seems like that's what needs to be tackled the most. Just going into, you know, how to incentivize better behavior. Because at the moment, it seems to be a game of incentives. People want to make money. People want to eat. People want to chow, to use a colloquialism, right? How do we get people to chow, but the normal man on the street still benefiting from the resources of the state? We look to see how all of these discussions continue, and I hope that as time goes on, that you know, we might find solutions that will be more inclusive and that will see more of us prospering and chowing at the end of the day. So that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcast under the Business Day Spotlight podcast tab on Twitter, where #BDSpotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, wherever you choose to get your pods casted. Thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail, and this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.